By the time he reached the cutout, filaments of pink were rising from the east. Everyone was there. Alicia was climbing from under the trunk line, dusting herself off. Everybody ready? Footsteps behind them. Peter wheeled around, drawing his blade. But then he saw, stepping from the undergrowth, the figure of Masami Patel. A cross was slung from one shoulder. She was wearing a pack. I tracked you from the storehouse. We better hurry. Mouse, Alicia began. Save your breath, Leash. I'm going. Masami focused her eyes on Peter. Just tell me one thing, she said. Do you believe your brother's dead? He felt as if he had been waiting for someone to ask him this very question. No. Neither do I. Her hand moved toward her belly, an unconscious gesture. Its meaning came upon him with such completeness it felt less like something discovered than remembered, as if he'd known all along. I never got the chance to tell him, Masami said. I still want to. Peter turned to Alicia, who was studying the two of them with a look of exasperation. She comes. Peter, this is not a good idea. Think about where we're going. Mausami's blood now. It's not a discussion. For a moment, Alicia said nothing. She appeared to be at a loss for words. The hell with it, she said finally. We don't have time to argue. Alicia went first, showing them the way. Sarah followed, then Michael, then Caleb and Masami, dropping into the tunnel one by one, leaving Peter to guard the rear. Amy was the last. They'd found a jersey and a pair of gaps for her and a pair of sandals. As she lowered herself through the hatch, her eyes found Peter's with a sudden beseeching force. Where are we going? Colorado, he thought. The CQZ. They were just names on a map, bits of colored light on the screen of Michael's CRT. The reality behind them, the hidden world of which they were a part, was nothing Peter could imagine. When they'd spoken of such a journey earlier that night, had it really been that same night, the four of them crowded into the lighthouse? Peter had envisioned a proper expedition. A large armed detail, carts of supplies, at least one scouting party, a meticulously plotted route. His father would spend whole seasons planning the long rides. Now here they were, fugitives on foot, scurrying away with little more than a pile of old maps and the blades on their belts. How could they possibly hope to get to such a place? I don't really know, he told her. But if we don't leave now, I think we'll all die here. She ducked into the tunnel and was gone. Peter tightened the straps of his pack and scrambled in behind her, pulling the hatch closed over his head, sealing himself in darkness. The walls were cool and smelled of earth. The tunnel had been dug long ago, perhaps by the builders themselves, to make it easier to service the trunk line. Except for the colonel, no one had used it for years. It was his secret route, Alicia had explained, the one he used to hunt. So at least one mystery was solved. 25 meters later, Peter emerged into a copse of mesquite. Everyone was waiting. The lights were down, revealing a gray dawn sky. Above them, the face of the mountain rose like a single slab of stone, a silent witness to all that had occurred. Peter heard the calls of the watch from the top of the wall, sounding off their posts for morning bell and the changing of the shift. Dale would be wondering what had happened to them, if he didn't know already. Surely it wouldn't be long before the bodies were found. Alicia closed the hatch behind him and turned the wheel, then knelt to cover it with underbrush. They'll come after us, Peter said quietly, crouched beside her. They'll have horses. We can't outrun them. I know. Her face was set. It's a question of who gets to the guns first. And with that, Alicia rose, turned on her heels, and began to lead them down the mountain. Part 7. The Darklands. I saw eternity the other night, like a great ring of pure and endless light, all calm as it was bright, and round beneath it time in hours, days, years, driven by the spheres, like a vast shadow moved in which the world and all her train were hurled. Henry Vaughan, The World. Chapter 42. They reached the foot of the mountain before half-day. The pathway, a switchback zigzagging down the eastern face of the mountain, was too steep for horses. In places it wasn't a path at all. 100 meters above the station, a portion of the mountain seemed to have been carved away. A pile of rubble lay below. They were above a narrow box canyon, the station obscured to the north by a wall of rock. A hot, dry wind was blowing. They climbed back up, searching for another route as the minutes ticked away. At last, they found a way down. They drifted off the path and made their final creeping descent. They approached the station from the rear. Inside its fenced compound, they detected no sign of movement. "You hear that?" Alicia said. Peter stopped to listen. "I don't hear anything." "That's because the fence is off." The gate stood open. That was when they saw a dark hump on the ground beneath the awning of the livery. As they moved closer, the hump seemed to atomize, breaking apart into a swirling cloud. A Jenny. The cloud of flies scattered as they approached. The ground around her was darkened with a stain of blood. Sarah knelt beside the body. The Jenny was lying on her side, exposing the swollen curve of her belly, bloated with putrefying gas. A long gash, alive with squirming maggots, followed the line of her throat. "She's been dead a couple of days, I'd say." Sarah's bruised face was wrinkled against the smell. Her lower lip was split. Her teeth were outlined with crusted blood. One eye, her left, was swollen with a huge purple shiner. "It looks like someone used a blade." Peter turned to Caleb. His eyes were open very wide, locked on the animal's neck. He'd pulled the neck of his jersey over the lower half of his face, a makeshift mask against the stench. "Like Xander's, Jenny? The one in the field?" Caleb nodded. "Peter." Alicia was gesturing toward the fence, a second dark shape on the ground. "Another Jenny?"
"I don't think so."
It was Ray Ramirez. There wasn't much left, just bones and charred flesh, which still exuded a faint smell of grilled meat. He was kneeling against the fence, his stiffened fingers locked in the open spaces between the wires. The exposed bones of his face made him appear to be smiling.
"That explains the fence," Michael said after a moment.
He looked like he might be ill.
"He must have shorted it out, holding on like that."
The hatch was open. They descended into the station, moving through its darkened spaces, room by room. Nothing seemed disturbed. The panel still glowed with current flowing up the mountain. Finn was nowhere to be seen. Alicia led them to the back. The shelf that hid the escape hatch was still in place. It was only when she opened the door and he saw the guns still in their boxes that Peter realized he'd feared they'd be gone. Alicia pulled a crate free and opened it. Michael gave an admiring whistle.
"You weren't kidding. They're like brand new."
"There's more where this came from." Alicia glanced up at Peter. "Think you can find the bunker on those maps?" They were interrupted by footsteps banging down the stairs. Caleb.
"Someone's coming."
"How many?"
"Looks like just one."
Alicia quickly doled out weapons. They ascended into the yard. Peter could see a single rider in the distance, pulling a boiling plume of dust. Caleb passed the binoculars to Alicia.
"I'll be damned," she said.
Moments later, Hollis Wilson rode through the gate and dismounted. His arms and face were caked with dust.
"We better hurry."
He paused to take a long drink from his canteen. "There's a party of at least 6 behind me. If we want to make it to the bunker before sundown, we should leave right now."
"How do you know where we're going?" Peter asked.
Hollis wiped his mouth with the back of his wrist.
"You forget." I rode with your father, Peter. The group had gathered in the control room. They were loading gear as fast as they could, whatever they hoped to carry. Food, water, weapons. Peter had spread the maps over the central table for Hollis to examine. He found the one he wanted. Los Angeles Basin and Southern California. According to Theo, the bunker was a 2-day ride, Peter said. Hollis frowned, his brow furrowed as he studied the map. Peter noticed for the first time that he'd begun to let his beard come in. For a second it felt to him as if it were Arlo standing there. I remember it as more like 3, but we were pulling the carts. On foot, I'd say we could do it in 2. He bent over the map, pointing. We're here, at the San Gorgonio Pass. The time I rode with your father, we followed this road, Route 62, north from the Eastern Road, Interstate 10. It's quaked out in spots, but on foot that should be no problem. We overnighted here, again he pointed, in the town of Joshua Valley. About 20 kilometers, but it could be as much as 25. Demo fortified an old fire station and laid in supplies there. It's tight, and there's a working pump so we can take water if we need it, which we will. From Joshua, it's another 30 clicks east on the 29 Palms Highway, another 10 due north across open country to the bunker. A hell of a walk. But you could do it in another day. If the bunker's underground, how do we find it? I can find it, all right. And believe me, you've got to see this place. Your old man called it the war chest. There's vehicles, too, and fuel. We never could figure out how to get one running, but maybe Caleb and the circuit can. What about the smokes? We never saw much of any through this stretch. Doesn't mean they aren't there. But it's high desert, which they don't like. Too hot? Not enough cover, no real game that we ever saw. Demo called it the Golden Zone. And farther east? Hollis shrugged. Your guess is as good as mine. The bunker's as far as I ever went. If you're serious about Colorado, I'd say our best bet is to stay off I-40 and work our way north to Interstate 15. There's a second supply cache in Kelso, an old railroad depot. It's rough terrain through there, but I know your old man got at least that far. Alicia would ride point. The rest of the group would follow on foot. Caleb was still signaling the all clear from the roof of the station as they loaded up their gear in the shade of the livery. The Jenny was gone. Hollis and Michael had dragged it to the fence. They should be in sight by now, Hollis said. I didn't think they were more than a few clicks behind me. Peter turned his eyes to Alicia. Should they go look? But she shook her head. It doesn't matter, she said with an air of finality. They're on their own now, same as us. Caleb descended the ladder at the rear of the station and joined them in the shade. They were a group of 8 now. Peter was suddenly aware how depleted they all were. None of them had slept at all. Amy was standing close to Sarah, wearing a pack like the others. She was squinting with a kind of fierce bravery in the sunlight, beneath an old visored cap somebody had found in the supply room. Whatever else was true about her, she wasn't used to the brightness. But there wasn't anything he could do about that now. Peter stepped away from the awning. He counted out the hands. 7 hours until darkness fell. 7 hours to cover 25 kilometers on foot across the open valley. Once they started, there would be no turning back. Alicia, her rifle slung from her shoulder, swung up onto Hollis's horse, a huge sandy-colored mare built like a house. Caleb passed her the binoculars. Everybody ready? You know, Michael said, technically, it's not too late to surrender. He was standing next to his sister, awkwardly holding a rifle across his chest. He looked at their silent faces. Hey, it was just a joke. Actually, I think Circuit has a point, Alicia declared from atop her mount. There's no shame in staying. Anybody who wants to should speak up now. No one did. All right then, Alicia said. All eyes. He wasn't cut out for this, Galen decided. He just wasn't. The whole thing had been a huge mistake from the beginning. The heat was killing him, the sun like a white explosion in his eyes. His ass was so sore from riding he wouldn't walk for a week. He had a screaming headache, too, where Alicia had clobbered him with a cross. And nobody in the party was listening to him. Nobody was doing a goddamn thing he said. Hey, guys, maybe we should close it up a little. We might want to slow down. What's the goddamn hurry?
Kill them, Gloria Patal had said. This little mouse of a woman, scared of her own shadow as far as Galen could tell, but from the looks of things, there were whole sides of Gloria Patal that he had never seen before. Standing at the gate, the woman was seething with rage.
Bring my daughter back here, but kill the rest of them. I want them dead.
The girl had done it. That's what everyone was saying. The girl and Alicia and Caleb and Peter and Michael and Jacob Curtis.
Jacob Curtis? How could that half-wit Jacob Curtis be responsible for anything?
It made no sense to Galen, but nothing about the situation did. Sense was no longer the point as far as he could tell. Not at the gate where everyone had gathered, all of them shouting and waving their arms. It was as if half the colony wanted to kill someone, anyone, that morning. If Sanjay had been there, he might have been able to talk a little sense into people, get them to calm down and think. But he wasn't. He was in the infirmary, Ian said, babbling and weeping like a baby. That was about the time that the crowd had gone to get Mar Curtis and dragged her to the gate. She wasn't the person they really wanted, but there was nothing to be done about it. The crowd was going wild. A pitiful scene. The poor woman who'd never had a bit of luck in her life, who didn't have an ounce of strength to resist, hustled up the ladder by 100 hands and thrown over the wall as everyone broke into cheers. It might have ended there, but the crowd was just getting started. Galen could feel it. The first one had simply given them a taste for more, and Hod Greenberg was yelling, "Elton! Elton was with them in the lighthouse!" And the next thing Galen or any of them knew, the crowd was rushing to the lighthouse, and under a storm of cheers, they hustled the old guy, the blind old guy, to the wall, and threw him over too. Galen, for his part, was keeping his mouth shut. How long before somebody said, "Hey, Galen, where's your wife? What about Mausami? Was she part of this too? Let's throw Galen over next." Finally, Ian had given the order. Galen didn't see the sense in going after them, but he was the only second captain now, since all the other seconds were dead, and he could tell Ian wanted to maintain at least the illusion that the watch was still in charge. Something had to be done, or the crowd would be throwing everyone over the wall. This was when Ian had taken him aside and told him about the guns. 12 crates of them, behind a wall in the storage room. "Personally, I don't care one way or the other about the walker," Ian said. "Your wife is up to you. Just bring me those fucking guns." They were a party of 5. Galen in command, Emily Darrell and Dale Levine in the second slot, with Hod Greenberg and Court Ramirez bringing up the rear. His first command outside the wall, and what did he have? That idiot Dale and a 16-year-old runner and 2 men who weren't even watch. A fool's errand, that's what this was. He released a heavy sigh, loud enough for the runner Emily Darrell riding beside him to ask him what was wrong. She had been the first to volunteer for the ride, the only one from the watch besides Dale. A girl with something to prove. He told her nothing, and let it go at that. They were almost through Banning now. He was glad he couldn't make out much in the way of detail, but the glimpses he got as they rode through town, you couldn't not look, creeped him to the bone. A bunch of caved-in buildings and dried-out slims roasting in their cars like strips of mutton, never mind the smokes who were probably skulking around somewhere. 1 shot. They come from above.
The watch drilled those words into your head from the time you were 8 years old, never once letting you in on the big secret, what nonsense it all was. If a smoke dropped down on Galen Strauss, he wouldn't stand a chance. He wondered how much it would hurt. Probably a lot. The truth was, the way things were, the whole Masami thing finally felt over. He wondered why he hadn't seen that before. Well, maybe he had and just hadn't been able to bring himself to accept it. He didn't even feel angry. Sure, he had loved her. Probably he still did. There would always be a place in his mind where Masami was. And the baby, too. The baby wasn't his, but still he found himself wishing it were. A baby could make you feel better about just about anything. Even going blind. He wondered if Mouse and the baby were okay. If he found them, he hoped that he'd be man enough to say that. I hope that you're okay. They approached the ramp to the eastern road, riding in two lines. Flyers, his fucking head was pounding. Maybe it was just the knock Alicia had given him, but he didn't think so. His whole vision seemed to be collapsing. Funny motes of light had begun to dance in his eyes. He felt a little sick. He was so wrapped up in his thoughts he didn't realize where he was, that he'd reached the top of the ramp. He paused to take a drink. The turbines were out there, somewhere, spinning in the wind that was pushing into his face. All he wanted was to get to the station and lie down in the dark and close his eyes. The dancing specks were worse now, descending through his narrowed field of sight like a glowing snowfall. Something was really wrong. He didn't see how he would be able to continue. Someone else would have to take the point. He turned to Dale, who had moved up behind him, saying, "Listen, do you think..." The space beside him was empty. He swiveled in his saddle. No one was behind him. Not one rider. Like a giant hand had plucked them, mounts and all, right off the face of the earth. A wave of bile rose in his throat. "Guys?" That was when he heard the sound, coming from beneath the overpass. A soft, wet ripping, like sheets of damp paper being torn in half, or the skin being pried off an orange, fat with juice. Chapter 43. They made Joshua Valley with just minutes to spare. By the time they reached the fire station, the light was nearly gone. The station was located on the western edge of town, a squat, square structure with a concrete roof and a pair of arched doors facing the street, sealed with cement blocks. Hollis led them to the rear, where the water tank sat in a thicket of tall weeds. The water that poured from the pump was warm and tasted of rust and earth. They all drank greedily, dumping great cascades over their heads. Never had water tasted so good, Peter thought. They gathered in the shade of the building while Hollis and Caleb pried loose the boards that covered the back entrance of the station. With a shove, the door spilled open on its rusted hinges, exhaling a wash of trapped air as dense and warm as human breath. Hollis took up his rifle again. "Wait here." Peter listened to Hollis's echoing footsteps moving through the dark space within. He was strangely unconcerned. They had come this far. It seemed impossible that the fire station would refuse them shelter for the night. Then Hollis returned. "All clear," he said. "It's hot, but it'll do." They followed him into a large, high-ceilinged room. The windows were sealed by more concrete blocks, with narrow slits at the top for ventilation, through which issued a yellow-tinted glow of fading daylight. The air smelled of dust and animals. A miscellaneous assemblage of tools and building supplies was pushed against the walls. Sacks of concrete, plastic troughs and hose encrusted with cement, a wheelbarrow, coils of rope and chain. The bays where the engines had once been were empty. Now the area served as a makeshift stable, with half a dozen stalls and tack hung on the boards. Along the far wall, a flight of wooden stairs ascended into nothing. The second floor was gone.
"Cots in the back," Hollis explained. He had knelt to fill a lantern from a plastic jug.
Peter saw the liquid's pale golden color and recognized the smell.
Not alcohol.
Petroleum.
All the comforts of home. There's a kitchen and bath, too, though there's no running water and the chimney's sealed.
Alicia was leading the horse inside.
What about this door? She asked.
Hollis lit the lantern with a match, paused to adjust the wick, and passed it to Masami, who was standing beside him.
Heights up, give me a hand.
Hollis retrieved a pair of wrenches and passed one to Caleb. Hanging from the joists over the front entrance, suspended by a pair of blocked chains, was a barricade of thick metal plates, framed by heavy timbers. They lowered it into position and bolted it to receivers set in the jam, sealing themselves inside.
Now what? Peter asked.
The big man shrugged.
Now we wait till morning.
I'll take first watch. You and the others should sleep. In the back room were the cots Hollis had spoken of, a dozen mattresses on sagging springs. A second door led to the kitchen and bathroom, with a row of rust-stained sinks below a cracked mirror and four toilet stalls. All of the windows were sealed. One of the toilets had been pulled out and now sat, its bowl tipped forward like the face of a drunken man, in the far corner of the room. In its place was a plastic bucket and, on the floor beside it, a pile of old magazines. Peter picked up the top one. Newsweek. On the cover was a blurry photo of a viral. There was something oddly flattened about the image, as if it had been taken from a great distance and very close at the same time. The creature was standing in some sort of alcove, in front of a device with the letters ATM written at the top. Peter didn't know what this was, though he'd seen one like it in the mall. On the ground behind the viral lay a single empty shoe. The two-word caption said, "Believe it." He returned with Alicia to the garage.
"Where are the rest of the supplies?" he asked Hollis.
Hollis showed him where the floorboards lifted up, revealing a recess about a meter deep, its contents covered by a heavy plastic tarp. Peter dropped down and pulled the tarp free. More jugs of fuel and water and, packed tightly together, rows of crates like the ones they'd found under the stairs at the power station.
"These 10 here are more rifles," Hollis said, pointing. "Pistols over there. We only moved the smaller weapons and no explosives. Demo didn't know if maybe they'd just blow up on their own and wreck the place, so we left them in the bunker."
Alicia had opened one of the crates, removing a black pistol. She pulled the slide, sighted down the barrel, and squeezed the trigger. They heard the sharp click of the hammer falling on an empty chamber.
"What kind of explosives?"
"Grenades, mostly."
Hollis tapped one of the crates with the toe of his boot.
"But the real surprise is this one here. Give me a hand."
The others had gathered around the hole. Hollis and Alicia stood on either side of the locker and hoisted it to the floor of the garage. Hollis knelt and opened it. Peter had expected more weaponry, so he was surprised to see a collection of small gray pouches. Hollis handed one to Peter. It weighed barely a kilo. On one side was a white label covered with tiny black writing. At the top were the letters M-R-E.
"It stands for meal ready to eat," Hollis explained. "Army food. There are thousands of them in the bunker." "You've got..." "Let's see," he said, and took the pouch Peter was holding, squinting at the tiny print. "Soy loaf with gravy. I've never had that one."
Alicia was holding one of the pouches, frowning at it skeptically.
"Hollis, these things have been ready for about 90 years. They can't still be good."
The big man shrugged and began passing the pouches around.
"A lot aren't. But if it's still airtight, you can eat it. Believe me, you'll know when you pull the tab. Most are pretty good. But look out for the beef stroganoff. Demo called it meal refusing to exit."
They were reluctant, but in the end too hungry to refuse. Peter had two, the soy loaf and a sweet, gluey pudding called mango cobbler. Amy sat on the edge of one of the cots to nibble suspiciously on a handful of yellow crackers and a wedge of what appeared to be cheese. From time to time she lifted her eyes warily. Then she returned to her furtive eating. The mango cobbler was so sugary it made Peter's head buzz, but when he lay down he felt his fatigue uncoiling in his chest and knew that sleep would grab him fast. His last thought was of Amy, nibbling on the crackers, her eyes darting over the room, as if she were waiting for something to happen. But this idea was like a rope in his hands he could not hold, and soon his hands were empty. The thought was gone. Then Hollis's face was floating above him in the dark. He blinked the fog of his disorientation away. The room was stifling. His shirt and hair were soaked with sweat. Before Peter could speak, Hollis silenced him with a finger held to his lips.
"Get your rifle, and come on."
Hollis, carrying the lantern, led him to the garage. Sarah was standing against the wall of concrete blocks where the bay doors had once been. A small observation port had been built into one of the doors. A metal plate that pulled aside in a track bolted into the concrete. Sarah stepped away.
"Take a look," she whispered.
Peter pressed his eyes to the opening. He could smell the wind in his nostrils, the cooling desert night. The window faced the town's main street, Route 62. Across from the fire station stood a block of buildings, ruined hulks, and behind them a softly undulating line of hills, all of it bathed in a bluish moonlight. Crouched in the roadway was a single viral. Peter had never seen one so motionless, at least not at night. It was facing the building, resting on its chiseled haunches, gazing at the building. While Peter watched, two more appeared out of the darkness, moving along the road and stopping to take up the same vigilant posture, facing the firehouse. A pod of three.
"What are they doing?" Peter whispered.
"Just standing there," Hollis said. "They move around a bit, but never come any closer." Peter pulled his face from the window.
"You think they know we're in here?"
"It's tight, but not that tight. They can smell the horse for sure."
"Sarah, go wake up Alicia," Peter said. "Keep quiet. It's best if everyone else stays asleep."
Peter returned his face to the window. After a moment he asked,
"How many did you say there were?"
"Three," Hollis answered.
"Well, there's six now."
Peter stood aside for Hollis to look. "This is bad," Hollis said.
"What are the weak spots?"
Alicia was beside them now. She freed the safety on her rifle and, making an effort to keep quiet, pulled the bolt. Then they heard it. A thump from above.
"They're on the roof."
Michael stumbled from the back room. He looked them over, frowning, his eyes blurry with sleep.
"What's going on?"
he said, too loudly. Alicia touched a finger to her lips, then pointed urgently to the ceiling. More sounds of impact came from overhead. In his gut, Peter felt it, a soft bomb exploding. The virals were searching for a way in. Something was scratching at the door. A thump of flesh on metal, of bone on steel. It was as if the virals were testing it, Peter thought, gauging its strength before they made a final push. He tightened the stock against his shoulder, ready to fire, just as Amy stepped into his line of vision. Later he would wonder if she'd been in the room all along, hiding in a corner, silently observing. She stepped to the barricade.
"Amy, get back!"
She knelt before the door, placing her palms against it. Her head was bowed, her brow touching the metal. Another thump from the far side, though softer this time, searching. Amy's shoulders were trembling.
"What's she doing?"
It was Sarah who answered.
"I think she's crying."
No one moved. There were no more sounds coming from the far side of the door now. Finally, Amy shifted off her knees and stood,
facing them all. Her eyes were distant, unfocused. She seemed not to be seeing any of them. Peter held up a hand. "Don't wake her." While they watched in silence, Amy turned and walked, with the same otherworldly air, to the door to the bedroom, just as Mausami, the last sleeper, emerged. Amy pushed past her without appearing to notice her. The next thing they heard was the squeak of rusted springs as she lay down on her cot.
"What's going on?" Mausami said. "Why is everybody looking at me like that?"
Peter went to check the window. He pressed his face against the slot. It was as he expected. Nothing was moving outside. The moonlit field was empty. "I think they're gone." Alicia frowned. "Why would they just leave like that?" He felt strangely calm. The crisis, he knew, had passed. "Look for yourself." Alicia slung her rifle and pressed her eyes to the window, her neck straining as she tried to widen her field of vision through the opening.
"He's right," she reported. "There's nothing out there."
She drew her face away and turned toward Peter, her eyes narrowed.
"Like pets?"
He shook his head, searching for the right word.
"Like friends, I think." "Will somebody please tell me what's going on?" Mausami said.
"I wish I knew," said Peter. They raised the barricade just after daybreak. All around them they saw the creature's tracks in the dust. None of them had slept much, but even so, Peter felt a new energy coursing through him. He wondered what this was, and then he knew. They had survived their first night out in the Darklands. The map spread out on a boulder. Hollis went over their route. "After 29 palms, it's open desert through here. No real roads. The trick to finding the bunker is this range of mountains to the east. There are two distinct peaks at the south end and a third behind them. When the third stands right in the middle of the two, turn due east and you're going the right way."
"What if we don't make it before dark?" he asked.
"We could hole up in 29 if we had to. There are a few structures still standing. But as I remember it, they're just hulks. Nothing like the fire station."
Peter glanced toward Amy, who was standing with the others. She was still wearing the brimmed cap from the supply room. Sarah had also given her a man's long-sleeved shirt to wear, frayed at the sleeves and collar, and a pair of desert glasses they'd found in the firehouse. Her black hair was pushed away from her face, a nimbus of dark tangles flapping under the brim of the cap.
"Do you really think she did it?" Hollis said.
"Sent them away."
Peter turned back toward his friend. He thought of the magazine in the bathroom, the two stark words on its cover.
"Truthfully, Hollis, I don't know."
"Well, we better hope she did. After Kelso, it's open country clear to the Nevada line." He drew his blade and wiped it on the hem of his jersey. When he resumed speaking, his voice was quiet, confidential. "Before I left, you know, I heard people talking, saying things about her. The girl from nowhere, the last walker. People were saying she was a sign."
"Of what?"
Hollis frowned. "The end, Peter. The end of the colony. The end of the war. The human race, or what's left of it. I'm not saying they were right. It was probably just more of Sam and Milo's bullshit."
Sarah stepped toward them. The swelling on her face had eased overnight. The worst of the bruising had faded to a greenish purple.
"We should let Mouse ride," she said.
"Is she okay?" Peter asked.
"A little dehydrated. In her condition, she has to keep her fluids up. I don't think she should be walking in the heat. I'm worried about Amy, too."
"What's wrong with her?"
She shrugged. "The sun? I don't think she's used to it. She's got a bad burn already. The glasses and shirt will help, but she can stay covered only so long in this heat."
She cocked her head and looked at Hollis.
So what's this Michael tells me about a vehicle?
They marched. The mountains fell away behind them. By half day, they were deep in open desert. The roadway was little more than suggestion, but they could still follow its course, tracing the bulge it made in the hardpan through a landscape of scattered boulders and strange stunted trees beneath a boiling sun and a limitless sky bleached of all color. The breeze hadn't so much died as collapsed. The air was so motionless it seemed to hum, the heat vibrating around them like an insect's wings. Everything in the landscape looked both close and far away, the sense of perspective distorted by the immeasurable horizon. How easy it would be, Peter thought, to get turned around in such a place, to wander aimlessly until darkness fell. Past the town of Mojave Junction, no town at all, just a few empty foundations and a name on the map, they crested a small rise to discover a long line of abandoned vehicles, two abreast, facing the direction they had come. Most were passenger cars, but there were some trucks as well, their rusted, sand-scoured chassis sunk in the drifting sand. It felt as if they'd stumbled on an open grave, a grave of machines. Many of the roofs had been peeled away, the doors torn off their hinges. The interiors looked melted. If there had once been bodies inside, they were long gone, scattered to the desert winds. Here and there in the undifferentiated debris, Peter detected a recognizable item of human scale. A pair of eyeglasses, an open suitcase, a child's plastic doll. They passed in silence, not daring to speak. Peter counted over 1,000 vehicles before they ended in a final plume of wreckage, the indifferent desert sands resuming. It was mid-afternoon when Hollis announced that it was time to leave the road and turn north. Peter had begun to doubt that they would ever make it to the bunker. The heat was simply overwhelming. A blazing wind was blowing from the east, pushing dust into their faces and eyes. Since the line of cars, no one had said much of anything. Michael seemed the worst off. He'd begun discernibly to limp. When Peter questioned him, Michael removed his boot without comment to show him a fat, blood-filled blister on his heel. They paused to rest in the sparse shadow of a yucca grove. "How much farther?" Michael asked. He'd taken off his boot for Sarah to attend to his blister. He winced as she pierced it with a small scalpel from the med kit she had found at the station. From the incision came forth a single bead of blood.
"From here? About 15 kilometers," Hollis said. He was standing away from them at the edge of the shade. "See that line of mountains? That's what we're looking for."
Caleb and Masami had fallen asleep, their heads propped on their packs. Sarah wrapped Michael's foot in a bandage. He wedged it back into his boot, grimacing with pain. Only Amy seemed little worse for the wear. She was sitting apart from the others, her skinny legs folded under her, watching them warily from behind her dark glasses. Peter went to where Hollis was standing.
"Will we make it?" he asked quietly. "It'll be close. Let's give everyone half a hand."
"I wouldn't go longer."
Peter's first canteen was empty. He allowed himself a sip from his second, vowing to hold the rest in reserve. He lay down with the others in the shade. It was as if he'd only just closed his eyes when he heard his name and opened them again to find Alicia standing over him.
"You said half a hand."
He rose on his elbows.
"Right. Time to go."
Another hand had passed before they saw the sign rising out of the wavering heat. First a long line of fencing, tall chain link with coils of barbed wire at the top, and then 100 meters inside the open gate, the small sentry house and the sign standing beside it. "You are entering the 29 Palms Marine Corps Air Ground Combat Center. Danger. Unexploded ordnance. Do not leave the road."
Unexploded ordnance?
Michael's face was compacted in a fierce squint.
"What does that mean?"
"It means watch your step, Circuit." Alicia directed her voice to everyone. "It could be bombs, Or maybe mine's. Single file. Try to step in the footprints of the person in front of you.
What's that?
Mausami was pointing with one hand, the other held over her brow against the glare.
Are they buildings?
They were buses. 32 of them parked in 2 closely spaced lines, their yellow paint almost entirely rubbed away. Peter stepped toward the closest bus at the rear of the line. The breeze had died. The only sound came from their footsteps on the hardpan. Below windows covered in heavy gauge wire were the words Desert Center Unified School District. He clambered up the dune of sand that was pushed against it and peered inside. More sand had blown through, subsuming the benches in wave-like drifts. Birds had roosted in the ceiling, staining the walls with the white paint of their droppings.
"Hey, look at this!" Caleb called.
They followed his voice around to the far side. Tipped onto its side was the shell of some kind of small aircraft.
"It's a helicopter," said Michael.
Caleb was standing on top of the fuselage. Before Peter could speak, Caleb had pulled the door open, like a hatch, and dropped down inside it.
"Hi, Top," Alicia called. "Be careful."
"It's okay. It's empty."
They heard him rummaging around the interior. A moment later, his head popped through the hatch.
"Nothing here. Just a couple of slims."
He chinned himself up. He slid down the fuselage and showed them what he'd found.
"They were wearing these."
A pair of necklaces, tarnished from exposure. To each was attached a silver disc. Peter used some of his water to rinse the tags clean. Sullivan, Joseph D., O positive, 09887-9254, USMC, ROM, Cath. Gomez, Manuel R., AB negative, 859720152, USMC, no pref.
USMC.
"That's Marine Corps," Hollis said. "You should put these back where you found them, Caleb." Caleb snatched the necklaces from Peter's hand, clutching them protectively against his chest.
"No way. I'm keeping these. I found them fair and square."
"Hi, Top. They were soldiers." Caleb's voice was suddenly shrill.
"So what? They never came back, did they? The soldiers were supposed to come back for us, and they never did."
For a moment, no one spoke. "That's what this place is, isn't it?" Sarah said. "Auntie used to tell stories about it. How the first ones came from the cities, to ride the buses up the mountain." Peter had heard these stories, too. He'd always thought of them as just that, stories. But Sarah was right. That's what this place was. More than the buses themselves, or the fallen helicopter with its dead soldiers inside, the stillness told him so. It was more than the simple absence of sound. It was the silence of something stopped. A feeling jarred him then, a prickling alertness. Something was wrong.
"Where's Amy?"
They fanned out through the lines of buses, calling her name. By the time Michael found her, Peter was completely frantic. He had never considered that she might wander off like this. Michael was standing beside one of the sunken buses, peering through an open window.
"What's she doing?" Sarah said.
"I think she's just sitting there," said Michael. Peter clambered up and pulled himself inside. The wind had pushed the sand to the rear of the vehicle. The first few lines of benches were exposed. Amy was sitting on the bench directly behind the driver's seat, holding her pack on her lap. She had removed her glasses and hat.
"Amy, it'll be dark soon. We have to go."
But the girl made no move to leave. She appeared to be waiting for something. She glanced around, her eyes pulled into a squint, as if noticing for the first time that the bus was empty. A ruin. Then she rose, drawing her pack onto her shoulders, and climbed out through the window. The bunker was just where Hollis had promised. He led them to a spot where the third mountain stood between the other two, turned east again,
and in half a click, he stopped.
"This is it," he announced.
They were facing a wall of rock. Behind them, the setting sun cut a final sliver of light across the horizon.
"I don't see anything," Alicia said.
"You're not supposed to."
Hollis slung his rifle and began to scramble up the wall. Peter watched him with a hand over his eyes against the reflected glare. 10 meters up, he disappeared.
"Where did he go?" Michael said.
The face of the mountain began to move. A pair of doors, Peter realized, made to blend with the surface as camouflage. They backed into the face of the hillside, revealing a dark cavern and the figure of Hollis standing before them. It took Peter a moment to absorb the full dimensions of what he was seeing. A vast vault, carved from the mountain itself. Rows of shelving extended into its dark recesses, stacked with pallets of crates that reached high above their heads. A forklift was parked near the entrance, where Hollis had opened a metal panel in the wall. As the group moved inside, he flipped a switch and the room suddenly thrummed with light, issuing from a network of glowing ropes on the walls and ceiling. Peter heard the airy hum of mechanical ventilation coming on.
"Hollis, these are fiber optics," Michael said, his voice lit with amazement. "What's the power source?"
Hollis flipped a second switch. A yellow warning beacon sprang to life, swiveling with a mad urgency over the doors. With a clunk of gears engaging, the doors began to slide from their pockets, dragging blades of shadow across the floor.
"You can't see them the way we came," Hollis explained, lifting his voice over the racket. "But there's a solar array on the south face of the mountain. That's how Demo found the place."
A hard bang as the doors closed, the echo ricocheting deep within. They were sealed away now, in safety.
"The stack won't hold much of a charge anymore, but you can run straight off the panels for a few hours. There are some portable generators, too. There's a fuel depot just a short walk north of here. Gas, diesel, kerosene. If you bleed it off right, it's still usable. There's more than we could ever use."
Peter advanced into the room. Whoever had constructed this place, he thought, they had built it to last. The room reminded him of the library. Only the books were crates, and the crates contained not words, but weapons. The leftovers of the last, lost war, boxed and stored for the war to come. He moved to the nearest shelf where Alicia was standing with Amy. Since the incident at the buses, the girl had stayed close, never venturing more than a few meters away. Alicia had pulled the base of her sleeve over her wrist to wipe away a layer of dust from the side of one of the crates.
"What's an RPG?" Peter asked.
"I have no idea," Alicia said.
She turned, smiling, to look at him.
"But I think I want one."
Chapter 44 From the Journal of Sarah Fisher, The Book of Sarah. Presented at the 3rd Global Conference on the North American Quarantine Period, Center for the Study of Human Cultures and Conflicts, University of New South Wales, Indo-Australian Republic, April 16th through 21st, 1003 AV. Excerpt begins.
Day 4. So I guess I'll just begin. Hello. My name is Sarah Fisher, First Family. I am writing to you from an army bunker somewhere north of the town of 29 Palms, California. I am one of 8 souls traveling from the San Jacinto Mountains to the town of Telluride, Colorado. It's strange to say these things to a person I don't even know, who may not even be alive when I'm writing this. But Peter says someone should keep a record of what happens to us. Maybe someday, he said, someone will want to know. We have been at the bunker 2 days. All things considered, it's pretty comfortable, with electricity and plumbing, and even a shower that works, if you don't mind cold water. I don't. Not counting the barracks, the bunker has 3 main chambers. One that seems to contain mostly weapons, the storeroom. Another with vehicles, the garage. and a third, smaller room with food and clothing and medical supplies. We don't have a name for it yet. We just call it the third room. This is where I found the notebooks and the pencils. Hollis says there's enough stuff here to outfit a small army, and I don't doubt it. Michael and Caleb are going to try to fix one of the Humvees, which is a kind of car. Peter thinks two of them should be able to carry the eight of us with supplies and enough extra fuel, though Michael says he doesn't know if he can salvage more than one from the parts we have. Alicia is helping them, though from the looks of it, she doesn't do much more than hand them the tools they ask for. It's nice to see her not bossing everyone around for a change. All of this belonged to the army, who are all dead now. I think I should say that. Also, that the reason we are here is the girl, named Amy, who is 100 years old, according to Michael. Though if you met her, you might not know this. You'd think she was just a girl. There was something in her neck, a kind of radio, which told us she comes from Colorado, in a place called the CQZ. This is a long story, and I'm not quite sure how to tell it. She can't talk, but we think there may be more people out there like her, because Michael heard them on the radio, and that is why we are going to Colorado. Everybody here has a job to do, and mine is to help Hollis and Peter figure out what's in the crates on the shelves. Peter says that as long as we're waiting on the Humvee, we might as well make use of the time, in case we need to come back here someday. Plus, we might find things we can use now, such as the walkie-talkies. Michael thinks he can make a couple of them work, if there are any batteries that will still take a charge. Off the storeroom, there's a kind of alcove we call the office, full of desks and computers that don't work anymore, and shelves, stacked with binders and manuals, and that was where we found the inventory lists, pages and pages of them, with everything from rifles and mortars to pairs of pants and bars of soap. I hope we find the soap soon. Each item is followed by a bunch of numbers and letters, which match the numbers and letters on the shelves, though not always. Sometimes you open a crate and think it will be blankets or batteries, and what you've got is shovels or more guns. Amy is helping us, and though she still hasn't said anything, today I realized she could read the list as well as anyone. I don't know why this surprised me, but it did. Day 6. Michael and Caleb are still working on the Humvees. Michael says there's two he can probably fix, but he's still not sure. He says the problem is anything rubber. A lot of it is cracked and falling apart. But I have never seen Michael so happy, and everyone thinks he will figure it out. Yesterday, I took inventory of the medical supplies. A lot of it is no good, but there are some things I think I can use. Real bandages and splints, and even a blood pressure cuff. I took Mouse's pressure, and it was 120 over 80, and I told her to remind me to take it every day and be sure to drink a lot of water. She said she would, but it makes her have to pee about every 5 minutes. This morning, Hollis took all of us out to the desert to show us how to shoot and throw a grenade. There's so much ammo, he said it was okay to use, and everyone ought to know. So for a while, we all shot off rifles at piles of rocks and threw grenades into the sand, and now my ears are ringing with the sound of it. Hollis thinks the area south of us is full of mines and says no one should go there. I think he was speaking mostly to Alicia, because she's been taking the horse to hunt in the early mornings before it gets too hot, though so far she hasn't got anything except a couple of jacks, which we cooked last night. Peter found a deck of cards in the barracks, and after dinner we all played go-to, even Amy, who won more hands than anyone, even though no one explained the rules to her. I guess she figured out just by watching. Real leather boots! We're all wearing them now, except for Caleb, who still has his sneakers. They're way too big, but he says he doesn't mind. He likes the way they look, and he thinks they're lucky, since he hasn't died since he put them on. Maybe we'll find a crate of lucky sneakers. Day 7. Still no progress in the Humvees. Everyone is beginning to worry we'll have to walk out of here. Apart from the boots, the best thing we've found so far are the light sticks. These are plastic tubes you snap over your knee and give them a hard shake and light comes out. A pale, glowing green. Last night, Caleb broke one open and put the glowing stuff all over his face and said, "Look at me, I'm a smoke now." Peter said that wasn't funny, but I thought it was, and most of us laughed anyway. I'm glad Caleb is here. Tomorrow I'm going to boil water and take a real bath and give Amy a haircut while I'm at it. At least do something about those tangles. Maybe I can get her to take a bath, too. Day 9. Michael said today they were going to try to start one of the Humvees, so we all gathered around while they hooked it up to one of the generators. But when they tried to turn the engine over, there was a loud bang and smoke, and Michael said they'll have to start from scratch. It was probably bad gas, he says, but I could tell he didn't really know. To make matters worse, the toilets backed up in the barracks, and Hollis said, "How is it the United States Army can make food that lasts 100 years, but they can't make a decent toilet?" Hollis asked me to give him a haircut, too. And I have to say, with a little cleaning up, he doesn't look half bad. Maybe I can get him to shave off the beard. But I think it means too much to him, with Arlo gone. Poor Arlo. Poor Hollis. Day 11. The horse was killed today. It was completely my fault. During the day, we've been keeping her staked outside in the shade, where there's some brush and weeds to graze on. I decided to walk her a bit, but then something spooked her and she got away. Hollis and I ran after her, but of course we couldn't catch her. And then we saw her out in the field where the mines were. And before I could say anything, there was a terrible boom. And when the dust cleared, she was lying on the ground. I was going to go after her, but Hollis stopped me. And I said, "We can't leave her like that." And he said, "No, we can't." And he went back to the barracks to get his rifle. And that was what he did. Both of us were crying, and after I asked him if he'd had a name for her. And he said yes. Her name was Sweetheart. We've been here just 9 days, but it feels like much longer. And I have begun to wonder if we are ever leaving this place. Day 12. The horse's body was taken away in the night, so now we know there are smokes around. Peter has decided to close the doors an hour before sunset just to be safe. I'm a little worried about Masami. In just the last few days, she started to show.